This is the Everything Financial Radio Podcast. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Thanks for tuning in once again today. I've got a very busy program for you today. This past week in Washington, some legislation passed the House that would dramatically change the way many folks will collect Social Security benefits. In short, it will eliminate Social Security collection options for many folks. You'll want to know what's going on, particularly if you are collecting a spousal benefit under Social Security, or if you're about ready to collect Social Security. I'll talk about that on today's program. Also joining me once again this week, Mr. John Doody. John is with Gold Stock Analyst, and we'll be talking to John again this week about, should you own gold stock, should you own gold, should you own both? If you're going to own gold stocks, what advice would he have for you? I'll be getting to my conversation with him momentarily. Also, Mr. Robert Murphy will be joining me. Bob is an economist who looks at things from an Austrian perspective. He's a fellow with the Ludwig von Mises Institute. I know you're going to enjoy my conversation with him as well. So again, a very busy program today. And before I get started, let me remind you that we do have a free resource available for you. It is the Portfolio Watch newsletter that is free. You can get a free subscription if you don't yet have one by visiting the website yourretirementoutlook.com. That's Y-O-U-R, yourretirementoutlook.com. I'm pleased to be chatting once again with Mr. John Doody. John is the publisher and editor of the Gold Stock Analyst, and you can get more information about his company at goldstockanalyst.com. And John, in your business of analyzing gold stocks, talk to the listeners about the relationship between the price of gold per ounce and what it costs to get an ounce of gold out of the ground. That's ultimately how profitability is determined.
Sure. There's several components of the cost of getting gold out of the ground. First are the direct costs of getting the gold. And that's the labor and explosives and steel and to build tunnels and that stuff. What is it? And it's called the cash cost per ounce. It's the actual cost in the direct cost of getting an ounce of gold out of the ground. And that right now runs between $600 and $700 an ounce. So without but that's not alone in the cost of getting gold out, because every mine needs a reinvestment of capital. To if it's an open pit mine, you have to lay back the walls to go deeper, because you know an open pit mine is basically like a cone going down into the ground, and as you go deeper to chase the ore down, you have to lay back all the sides to do that. So that takes an investment that's an ongoing investment. It's just not the cost of building the mine to begin with. It's what is the capital cost to keep that mine in operation, and that's typically around $300 an ounce. So between the capital cost and the cash cost, the two add up to what's called the sustaining cost for a mine, and that's around $1,000 an ounce for a typical mine. And then on top of that, you've got to do exploration. You've got of course overhead and people at the headquarters, and you've got stockholder costs and so forth. So the general thought is that around $1,200 an ounce is a number that allows you to cover your costs and to make a reasonable return on your investment. Not a great return, a reasonable return.
So, John, if someone's out there and they're saying, you know what, I'd like to have some gold stock exposure in my portfolio, why should someone consider buying individual gold stocks versus going out and buying, you know, one of the big ETFs that just is made up of the major gold miners or even the junior stocks?
Well, good question. That's why we exist. There's probably 1,000 gold mining stocks. Over 900 of those, though, are just explorers. And they're not producing anything. They're looking for gold. And they're basically buying a lottery ticket. And some of those guys are going to hit it, but most of them aren't, and they really spend more of their time mining investors to get more money to keep doing exploration than they do actually developing mines. And so we totally ignore those people, and we focus on the latter on 60 gold mining stocks, and these are either miners or near producing miners that have an engineering study that says this mine would work at this price and so forth, and they're in the process of building a mine. And if you look at the whole segment of all the mining companies, they really break down into five different groups. First are what we call the majors. These are the great big guys, the Barracks and the Newmonts. These are elephants that don't really know how to dance, and they're just big and monolithic. Most of the indexes are comprised of market cap weighted. The Barracks and the Newmonts overwhelmingly control the index itself because they're just so big, so much of a part of it. And then below that, you've got a sort of an intermediate class of producers that goes from 100,000 ounces a year up to, you know, 1.5 million, something like that. And within that, there's a subset of growth producers, and that's an area we focus on. Who's got growth within that subset? And then beyond that, you've got royalty companies. The royalty companies are companies that basically either have a royalty on the production. In other words, it's like a sales tax that they bought years ago. Oftentimes, they funded some exploration, and the mine got developed, and they end up having a 2 or 3% sales tax, or NSR royalty, as it's called, on production. Or they do streaming transactions, and this has been a new feature of the industry, where the royalty companies, which are very very profitable, help finance new mine construction, acquisitions, and so forth, and the royalties companies. Have big portfolios. You know, they may have a dozen streams, and they may have royalties themselves of 20 or 30 different mines. So we like those companies, and we also look at developers, companies that already got a project that are now in the process of building this project. And when a company's building a project, there's not really a lot of news that comes out. It's not very exciting that two more trucks got delivered to the mine site. And so they tend to languish in the marketplace, and if you can find a developing company that's got a great site, it's already building the mine, and there's a lack of news, that oftentimes the stock price sinks, and you can get in for the bargain, that's at a bargain price relative to what it's going to trade at when it's a producer. So those segments of the subset of the market, you can't differentiate them in the ETFs. They're basically, the ETFs have to own everything. And you can't do it in a mutual fund either, because the mutual funds have to own too many stocks. There's too many dogs in this industry to want to own 30 or 40 different stocks. We focus on 10, the GSA top 10. And our top 10, this is an audited results. We have an independent auditor come in and examine our trades. There aren't that many. A couple of year, every year, and certify that yes, these were the results of our model portfolio. And over this millennium, the last 14 years, our top 10 has averaged 27% gain a year. Now there's some down years in that, but there's also been some up years. And versus the XAU Gold Index, which is our benchmark, the XAU is only up 6%. So we've outperformed the XAU by a factor of four. Over this period of time, and versus gold is up 12% over this period of time, whereas our top 10 is up 27%. So we've proven that you can beat the ETFs and you can beat the metal, but you need guidance in this. You can't and you need somebody who crunches the numbers and tracks it and figures out which stocks are cheap, which stocks are expensive, and so forth. And that's basically the nature of our work. We analyze in the main publication, we analyze 60 stocks and distill this down to a 10 stock list, and that's our GSA top 10.
Well, great having you on the program, John. We're going to have to leave it there for today. If you'd like more information on John's work, I would encourage you to check out goldstockanalyst.com. That's goldstockanalyst.com. And John, thanks for joining us today.
Okay, glad to be with you, Dennis.
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio podcast. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you're listening today, and special thanks again over the last couple of weeks to Mr. John Doody for joining us. I'll be getting to my conversation with Mr. Bob Murphy momentarily. Before I do, I want to remind you of a free weekly resource that we have available for you. You can get our free Portfolio Watch newsletter by simply visiting the website, yourretirementoutlook.com. yourretirementoutlook.com, and sign up by giving us your name and email. The website again to get the free Portfolio Watch newsletter, yourretirementoutlook.com. I am pleased to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Bob Murphy. Bob is a research assistant professor at Texas Tech. He's an economist with the Institute for Energy Research, also a research fellow with the Independent Institute, and an associated scholar at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. In 2007, he wrote the book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism, and in 2009 wrote The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal. His most recent book is Choice. And Bob, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Bob, let's talk first of all about your book, Choice. Explain to the listeners what it's all about.
Sure thing. So it's called Choice, and the subtitle is Cooperation, Enterprise, and Human Action. And the reason for that subtitle is what the book is. It's a modern restatement that's accessible to the layperson of the insights of the economist Ludwig von Mises. And so his famous work was called Human Action. So that's my book, Choice, takes human action and makes it accessible to the masses. Mises was a giant, what's called Austrian economics, that many of your listeners may know what that is. It's a school of thought. So there's the Chicago school, the Keynesian school, but there's also the Austrian school. And they're, in particular, I focus on their theory of the business cycle and why they think that there's boom busts. Because according to the Austrians, it's not just something inherent to capitalism. It's actually due to central banks artificially pushing down interest rates that causes an unsustainable bubble.
Well, let's expand on that a little bit, because we on the program here have talked a lot about economic cycles based on the Kondratiev wave theories and the fact that currencies cycle. And all this is based on the fact that human behavior tends to be predictable. So would it be fair to say that it's your restatement of von Mises' work that the behavior of central bankers is also predictable?
Oh, well, that's an interesting way of putting it, because it's funny. In general, the Austrians are very skeptical of mathematical models of human behavior and stress the importance of free will and so on. But you are right that they do have a theory to explain, you know, this is what the pattern is when it comes to business cycles. So it's, I guess the way I would put it is the Austrians are saying, we don't know what central bankers will necessarily do, but if they do flood the markets with cheap credit and push down interest rates and give a false signal, that will definitely have predictable results. That it'll, because according to the Austrians, the interest rate serves a purpose. It's a signal, it's a price that helps coordinate things over time. And so if that number is artificially low because the central bank, you know, floods the market with cheap credit, for example, well, then entrepreneurs are going to invest on invest in projects that really they shouldn't be investing in.
So let's talk about the recent policies of the central bank. Back during the financial crisis of 2008, we'll say, Ben Bernanke stepped up and said, we're going to engage in quantitative easing. And I think the Fed has actually printed $4.5 to $5 trillion of money virtually out of thin air. What effect has that had on the economy, in your view?
Well, I think it's going to have a bad effect, and it has had it, and it's going to continue to get worse. Because according to the Austrian view, which I definitely think is correct in this instance, what happened was you have to ask yourself, step backwards and say, wait a minute, why was there a financial crisis all of a sudden in 2008? Did that just come? Is that like an earthquake or a hurricane? And the Austrians would say, no, what it was is that back when the dot-com crash happened, right, early 2000s, what Alan Greenspan was the chair at the time, and he did the same thing from the Keynesian playbook. He pushed down interest rates. Everyone was calling him the maestro because what he ended up doing was replacing the dot-com bubble with the housing bubble. And so in the Austrian view, the central bank is not doing us any favors by just giving us another asset bubble to replace the previous one, right? The point's not to goose spending and to get short-term consumer spending up. It's rather to allow resources to go to where they're supposed to for sustainable growth. And so there, what Bernanke did was merely fuel speculation in certain asset markets and postpone the inevitable adjustment. So in my mind, all he did was postpone the crisis and make it fester, and it's going to be that much worse than if we had just endured what would have been admittedly awful back in the fall of 2008, but it would have been over in 6 months.
So let's expand on that, and just let me remind listeners that may be joining us. We're chatting today with Mr. Bob Murphy. He's the author of the book Choice. What would that have looked like had the Fed not intervened and printed money and the too big to fail banks were actually bailed out? Assuming that market forces were allowed to play this out, what would have happened and why do you think it would have been over in 6 months?
Well, sure, that's a great question. So I think the first thing to make sure your listeners reflect upon is just because a particular financial institution goes bankrupt, it doesn't mean tractors disappear. It's not like farmland all of a sudden goes away or factories literally disappear. Those real physical assets are still there, and all that happens is there's a bankruptcy proceeding, and then the owners get rearranged, you know, according to the creditors and whatever the relationships were and who had seniority on the debt and so forth. So I think that's one thing to keep in mind. And then another element is people have this idea because they were, you know, they had it yelled at them throughout that period saying, oh, we want to avoid another depression, and we're supposed to really be happy that they engaged in all those unprecedented bailouts. And look, if things weren't as bad as the 30s. But, you know, I have a book on the 1930s. As you said, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and New Deal. It wasn't that, oh, there was a big stock market crash in 1929, and that by itself and a bunch of banks failed gave us a decade of depression. No, the reason we had a decade of depression back then was that Herbert Hoover and then FDR came in and ratcheted up all sorts of unprecedented government interventions at that time. So that's what I mean, that these periods that people have in mind of what happens if the market's left to itself is actually the exact opposite. Where you get a bad economy and just malaise in a slump for a long time is where the government comes in, rolls up its sleeves, and promises to help us. And unfortunately, everyone diagnoses that as the workings of the free market. Left to itself, the market, you know, those investment banks would have gone down. Maybe Goldman would have gone down. Who knows? And then those assets would have been transferred to more responsible owners, and people would have learned their lesson. They would have said, okay, the next time there's a bubble and things look too good to be true, be prudent in how you invest, because when it blows up, you'll go out of business. Whereas now, the lesson taught was make profits hand over fist while the bubble's going up, and then don't worry, you'll get bailed out.
Well, we've got just about a minute and a half left in this segment. You mentioned the dot-com bubble was replaced by the housing bubble. Is there a bubble that exists today? Did we replace the housing bubble with something else?
Well, that's a great question. So I definitely think the U.S. equity markets are overvalued right now. And, I mean, if you're just as an exercise, that until you see it, it's pretty surprising. If you chart the S&P 500 level against the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, you know, their total assets, it is remarkable. They move hand in glove since 2009, that whenever the Fed was doing a QE program, the market was rising up. When the Fed would slow, you know, would taper off and have just a constant amount of assets, the market would drop suddenly. And we certainly saw that this time around back in, in August, when the market fell pretty heavily. That was on fears the Fed was getting ready to raise rates. So it's not healthy for the U.S. stock market to so clearly be tied to every syllable that comes out of the throat of the Federal Reserve chairman, or chairwoman in this case. So that's one example. I think U.S. equities. Also, I think U.S. treasuries right now, I don't think that those very low yields are going to be around 20 years from now. I think that that's also, you could call it a bubble, meaning that it is for in terms of how much debt the U.S. government has been issuing and how low those yields are. I don't think that that's a normal market reaction.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for this segment. Our guest today is Mr. Bob Murphy. He's the author of the book Choice, and we'll continue our conversation with him when Everything Financial Radio continues. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. My guest today is Mr. Bob Murphy. Bob is a research assistant professor at Texas Tech. He's also an economist with the Institute for Energy Research. He is a research fellow with the Independent Institute and associated scholar at the Ludwig von Mises Institute. His most recent book is Choice, and we've been chatting with him about the book as well as his take on the potential outcomes here as a result of Fed policy. And Bob, let me jump in there because in our past segment, you said something that I thought was interesting, and that was the causes of the Great Depression, which relates back to your 2009 book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression, The New Deal. Let me just ask you this. As an economist, do you see parallels between current economic conditions and government or Federal Reserve policies today and prior to the Great Depression?
Oh, definitely. So the standard, you know, mantra that I certainly learned this when I was in school is that in the 1920s, that was before our far-sighted government intervention, and back then it was pure laissez-faire, and people could do whatever they want, and the government just sat back, and we just saw the natural market unfold, and they would say, oh, the reason you had the stock market rise so much was because there wasn't the SEC, and the, you know, there were no limits on margin trading and so forth, and that just was rampant capitalism run amok, and there was a huge run-up and then a crash. But actually, as I explained in the book, that's not entirely true. There was a huge effort by the Federal Reserve in the mid-20s to bail out the Bank of England. All right, I obviously have to cut the story short here just for the interest of brevity, but because of the First World War, all the major powers had gone off the gold standard, and so the British pound was devalued because they printed up a bunch of money to pay for the war effort, and so Great Britain was trying to get the pound back on the pre-war gold parity. And so the Federal Reserve, to make that easier, started inflating, right? They wanted to reduce the value of the dollar relative to the pound to make it easier for Great Britain to go back on the gold standard in the 20s. And so that's when you see the U.S. stock market start to rise. So there, it was not a natural outgrowth of just the roaring 20s and pure capitalism and greed. It was Federal Reserve, a conscious Federal Reserve policy to start injecting more money. And that's when you saw in the mid-20s the stock market really take off. So that... But even there, that's not the whole story. There had been plenty of times up to that point in U.S. history where there were financial, they called them panics, and you know they weren't a decade-long affair where the economy was awful for that long. They were over fairly quickly. They were sharp and short. What made this particular depression and panic different was Herbert Hoover said, I'm not going to let wages fall. And he did all sorts of things. The Reconstruction Finance Corporation ran what at that time were unprecedented peacetime budget deficits. So this idea we have from the history books that Herbert Hoover just sat back doing nothing because he loved the Constitution so much, that is totally wrong. In fact, in the book I quote one of the chief lieutenants in the Roosevelt administration later on in the 30s admitted that everything they had done in the New Deal was just an extension of what Herbert Hoover had done in his one term. So, again, it's if you step back and look at it, you say, why did the Great Depression happen when it did? It's not because of laissez-faire. It's because they did all sorts of interventions at that point. And the Federal, one last thing I'll say is, in the early 30s, the Federal Reserve did try to stimulate. They cut interest rates to try to spur investment and so on. So they did qualitatively the same sorts of things that modern central banks do. The difference was just, you know, they were at that point were still on the gold standard, and so they couldn't do it as much, whereas now... all bets are off, and they can flood unprecedented amounts of money into the markets.
So I sit here and I listen to you, Bob, and I'm thinking about the fact that today we have a national debt of approaching $18.5 trillion officially. There's unfunded liabilities of Social Security. We'll call it $17.5 trillion, underfunded liabilities of Medicare, maybe $85 trillion. We've got this massive, as Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff says, we've got this huge fiscal gap. And we've got the Federal Reserve now really, really printing money to arguably maybe subsidize all this deficit spending. What's the end game in your view? How does all this play out?
Well, I think you put your finger on something really important there that a lot of analysts just either don't pay attention to or if it is brought to their attention, they just sort of poo-poo it. And that is the extent to which the Federal Reserve, particularly in the last few years, has been monetizing the federal government's budget deficits. And so I mean, there were certain periods, I think it's receded, I haven't checked the latest figures, but there was a period there where a surprisingly large percentage of the new federal debt being issued was being absorbed, you know, through secondary markets, of course, by the Federal Reserve. So, that you know, in other words, if you looked at how much is the increase in the federal debt, and then you looked at the Fed's balance sheet and how many treasuries did they accumulate, it was a surprisingly large percentage. And so in the way the average pundit on CNBC or whatever would dismiss that and say, oh, no, those are completely independent things. The federal government's over here running its budget deficit in order to run the stimulus programs and what have you, and the Fed's over here doing its QE programs in order to stimulate the economy. But I think that's pretty naive. I think that those two things did have a lot to do with each other. And again, that going back to your earlier question about where's the bubble, I think it's not a coincidence or when people say, oh, no, the federal government investors around the world have no doubt about their solvency and their ability to repay. Look at how low yields are in 30-year treasuries. I think part of the reason for that confidence, if you will, is that they know the Fed's waiting in the wings to print up money and buy those treasuries. And so investors know they're going to get paid the dollars. The question is just, what's that dollar going to buy in the marketplace?
You know, Bob, that brings me to, I'm thinking of what the late economist Herbert Stein said. He said, if something cannot go on forever, it will stop. A very profound statement. When does the money printing stop and how? And aren't the economic consequences as a result of all these policies just going to be that much more severe?
Well, that's a good question. And so here, I have a bit of a contrarian take, if you will, that I actually think they brought in Yellen with the understanding that she was going to draw the line in the sand. So if you look back, I did this exercise. I went back at least to Volcker. If you go back, you know, in terms of history of Fed chairs and look at the dates of when did they come in, when were they sworn in and took over the reins at the Fed, and then when was there a major financial, you know, shock afterwards? It's surprisingly short for many of them. And the obvious example is Alan Greenspan. When he came in, it was only a few months later that you had the 87 stock market crash. And so with Yellen, and so if you think of in terms of Austrian business cycle theory, that they have a boom-bust cycle, right? The Fed chair can flood the market with money, pushed out interest rates, causes a boom, and then there has to be a bust. But they do have some discretion about when the bust occurs. So if they take their foot off the gas, you know, the bust will occur sooner rather than later. And so I think in terms of the political economy and just the way, you know, legacies work and so on, that the Fed chairs have this pattern where one person will come in and then the major crash will happen early on in his or her watch that he inherited from the last person, and then he'll blow up his own bubble and then hand the keys over to the next guy and say, okay, I'm going to go write my memoirs and spend time with my family now. So with Yellen, if you look at the timing of when the taper happened, it was supposed to happen earlier, and then Bernanke postponed it, and it was like the last month when he was officially still Fed chair that the taper really kicked in. They turned things over to Yellen. If you look at the Fed's balance sheet, you know, with the taper was finished back in, I think it was October of 2014. So the Fed, even though they've kept interest rates low, they on net, they have not accumulated more assets in over a year at this point. And so I really do think that the Fed, they're not trying to consciously crash things, but I think they did recognize we just can't keep throwing more money at this. We got to hold the line at some point and let this crash occur. So my guess is that they're not going to launch another QE and they're going to let things adjust. And they're really just tinkering with interest rates at this point, that they're not buying more. They haven't been buying more assets in over a year.
So if assuming we move ahead, Bob, and we do see the stock market crash, we see maybe another real estate bubble burst. Real estate's back almost to where it was prior to the crash. The Fed's going to naturally want to take action. What action can they take other than printing?
Well, it's funny. They at this point, what I have a paper where I refer to Ben Bernanke as the FDR of central bankers, and what I meant by that was, if you think back, what role did FDR play in terms of U.S. history and the public's understanding of the proper functions of the federal government? It's that he, more than any other president, was responsible for getting the public to think that in a crisis, it's the federal government's job to do X, Y, Z, and so on to fix things, whereas before him, you know, that wasn't nearly as much as what the public thought. And so that's the same thing that Bernanke has done, that you're right. Before him, people would think, oh, yeah, the Fed can lower interest rates maybe, but if that doesn't work, you know, what more can they do? And then it was under Bernanke's leadership where the Fed began intervening in very specific markets, so buying mortgage-backed securities, for example, and things like that, and all those acronyms of the various lending discount windows and things that they started, those extraordinary programs in late 2008. So to answer your question, I think, unfortunately, I mean, yes, obviously, ultimately, the power of the Fed and the ability to help, in quotation marks, comes from their legal ability to create new U.S. currency. But beyond that, I think people will have all sorts of proposals for very particular interventions and things like, oh, why don't they intervene in this particular asset market and buy up these, or why don't they give, you know, backstop guarantees to these people or so forth. So I think that depending on what the specific crisis is, the Fed may come in and do all sorts of very particular things, again, expanding its power, because the Federal Reserve is a bureaucracy like any other one, and the people running it tend to rise to the top who will expand its powers and strengthen that bureaucracy.
So, Bob, last question. As a member of the Austrian School of Economic Thought, do you see any country in the world at any time in the future returning to the gold exchange standard or something similar in order to maybe create some honest currency again?
Well, another great question. This is more of a sort of historical and personality and political analysis. So here I'm just throwing this out there. I think that what these major powers could do, because for a while, Russia and certainly China, you know, they have been agitating and trying to displace, you know, the U.S. dollar as the world's primary reserve currency. And so it seems to me that one obvious way they could really solidify that would be if they just came out and officially announced to investors around the world that we're tying our currency not to other currencies, or we're not, you know, having an inflation target, but we will go back to a commodity standard. And you know, they might not pick one, like gold. They might do like a basket of commodities or something like that. But to me, that would certainly be a way that they could get people to adopt their currency, and that would soon displace the other ones. But even there, the problem is, and this is what happened with the original gold standard, is ultimately state officials, you can't trust take them at their word. And so I think even if they did do that, the point would just be to gain market share, if you will, to get people to use their currency. And then once a crisis came down the road, they too would abandon it and print money.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Bob Murphy. Bob is the author of the book Choice. Bob, it's been a pleasure having you on the program today, and we'd love to have you back.
Thanks for having me, Dennis.
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you tuned in today. You know, as I mentioned at the outset of today's program, this past week there was some legislation that passed the House that could significantly change the way a lot of folks collect Social Security benefits. There's some Social Security benefit collection options that appear to be coming off the table. It appears that this change could happen as quickly as 6 months. However, the bill that passed the House this past week awaits Senate approval. Now, let me just explain to you what's going on, because this could really dramatically affect the way you collect income during retirement, particularly if you are currently collecting Social Security on a spousal benefit on your spouse's earnings, or if that's something that you intended to do. Now, I've got a couple different articles that seem to do a pretty good job of sorting this out. I'd like to share those with you on today's program. And one of the articles actually cites Boston University professor Lawrence Kotlikoff, who many of you probably recognize that name. Professor Kotlikoff has been a frequent guest here on the program. And I intend to attempt to get Professor Kotlikoff back on the program here within the next few weeks to bring you completely up to speed. So certainly stay tuned for that. There's an article that was published on ThinkAdvisor, and all the articles I'm going to share with you today are from October 28. This article is titled, Popular Social Security Claiming Strategy Gutted in Budget Bill. The budget bill that passed the House on Wednesday and awaits Senate approval would kill the file and suspend Social Security benefit claiming strategy. Boston University professor Lawrence Kotlikoff slammed the measures to change Social Security spousal benefits under the deal Wednesday in his blog. The file and suspend benefits claiming strategy allows a spouse to receive benefits while the main beneficiary suspends theirs in order to hold out for a bigger payment in the future. Now, let me explain what file and suspend actually means. Now, if you think about collecting Social Security benefits, one of the terms that you need to be familiar with is a term called normal retirement age. And today, if you're retiring today, your normal retirement age is age 66. At age 66, you can collect your full benefit, a benefit known as your primary insurance amount, under Social Security. Now, if you collect Social Security prior to your normal retirement age, which is 66, your benefit, your primary insurance amount, is discounted. It just means you'll collect less per month in Social Security benefits. However, if you wait to collect Social Security benefits until after age 66, if you defer collecting benefits, you get something that is called a delayed benefit credit. and you can delay collecting Social Security benefits till age 70, in which case your benefits grow at 8% per year simple interest. So to give you an example, if your primary insurance amount at your normal retirement age of 66 is $2,000 a month, in other words, if that's the amount you would collect from Social Security at your normal retirement age, at age 70, that benefit would increase by 32%. You'd collect $2,640 per month. Now, let's just use an example of this file and suspend strategy now that you have that background. Let's say that you and your spouse are 66. One of you could file for your Social Security benefits. The second could file for spousal benefits. Now, a spousal benefit is based on the earnings history of your spouse. So in this case, one spouse draws normal benefits based on their earnings history. They draw their primary insurance amount at age 66, and their spouse draws a spousal benefit, which is half of their primary insurance amount. So in this case, if the primary insurance amount is $2,000 a month, the spousal benefit would be $1,000 a month. The spouse that's drawing the spousal benefits would now collect the spousal benefits for 4 years and collect their primary insurance amount benefits at age 70. And the end result is they get a 32% increase in their benefit. Now, the other option is spouse number one could simply file and suspend. Just means they file for benefits and immediately change their mind and say, I want to suspend my benefits. They never collect a check. By doing that, the second spouse will automatically qualify to collect spousal benefits, even though the first spouse is no longer collecting. The second spouse can then wait to draw their primary benefits at age 70. It means their benefits increase by 32%. The first spouse can do the same thing. So they both collect a benefit that's 132% greater than their primary insurance amount. And it's this loophole, as some folks call it, that Congress wants to change. So there's a planner by the name of Michael Kitchis who writes something called Nerd's Eye View, and he says this. He said it will no longer be possible to file a restricted application for just spousal benefits under Social Security. And with an extension of the suspension rules that stipulate suspending an individual's benefits, will also suspend any benefits to other people based on the same earnings record, Congress has killed off the various file and suspend strategies to allow spousal and dependent benefits to be paid while still earning delayed benefit credits. That means while you're still waiting to collect Social Security in order to make your benefit larger. Professor Kotlikoff wrote this. In his Forbes blog this week, he said these changes are potentially devastating. Kotlikoff wrote this. In 6 months, benefits now being received by spouses, divorced spouses, or children on the work record of a spouse, ex-spouse, or parent who has suspended his or her benefits will be eliminated until the worker restarts his or her retirement benefits. The professor said, I've never heard of a change in Social Security law that eliminates benefits for people already collecting, but that's what's in this bill. The result, Kotlikoff writes, this will cost millions of households tens of thousands of dollars. Worse, it will induce those who have suspended their benefits in order to collect higher benefits at 70 to restart their benefits at permanently lower levels in order to maintain their family's immediate living standards. Now, that same day, Bloomberg Business reported that this version was actually changed. And I'll give you just a bit from that article. An original version of the budget bill ended file and suspend in 6 months for everyone using the strategy. That would have abruptly cut off checks to thousands of retirees or many more. Today, the deal was amended so it affects only retirees who file for benefits in the future, and the change wouldn't go into effect for 6 months. That means older workers who want to use the strategy could still do so until early next year. Kiplinger ran an article published the same day that seems to confirm that that is the case. And again, I will get the professor on the program here, if possible, in the next few weeks, just to confirm how all this will work. Kiplinger says the file and suspend ban will go into effect 6 months after enactment. That means people who are getting benefits now under the strategy will continue to receive them, and those who want to try to maximize lifetime family benefits using this strategy will be able to for a while longer. You must be at least age 66 to use this tactic, and the window will probably close around May 1, 2016. So the summary, really, for this segment is this. First of all, it's my view that this will not be the first significant change we see to Social Security. The math dictates there will have to be other changes. According to the Social Security trustees, Social Security is $17.5 trillion underfunded. Couple that with a national debt now of about $18.5 trillion, and we will have to see significant changes. The bottom line for you is this. Now is a good time to do Social Security collection planning and retirement income planning. We'd like to help you by offering you a free resource that may give you a different perspective. If you'd like to get our Investor's Discovery Kit that contains the book New Retirement Rules, as well as a copy of the New Economy magazine, as well as an educational CD and DVD, all you have to do is visit the website, investingapproach.com. The website, once again, investingapproach.com. That concludes our podcast for this week. Hope you got something you can use. Thanks for listening.